That's Booker T of the old Booker T and the MGs with Green Onions. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Wednesday, April the 23rd, and let's get started. Well, for several decades, the state has been more segregated for blacks than any southern state, though the South has a much higher percentage of African-American students, said a report recently released by the University of California, Los Angeles, Civil Rights Project. Professor Gary Orfield, he's a professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at UCLA, details the findings of this report, and this report has tracked the trends in public school education in New York and other East Coast cities over the past 60 years. Thank you, Professor, for being with us today, Professor Orfield. Is he with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very well now. Thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Now, this was a very, very strong... did this surprise you that the findings surprised even you, even though, of course, you did the report? Did it surprise you what you found?
Well, it's very disappointing, but it isn't very surprising because we've been looking at these patterns every few years for more than 30 years, and New York has consistently been extremely segregated. And since it's done nothing to address this issue in decades, it's not surprising that it remains extremely segregated. I think the fact that it's worse than any place else for African-American students is deeply disappointing, and the fact that it really is hardly talked about there and it's just accepted as normal is very disturbing.
Yes, the title itself is very disturbing. New York State's Extreme School Segregation, Inequality, Inaction, and a Damaged Future. Could you talk about the main findings of the report?
Well, basically, the report looks at New York State. We've looked at actually every state in the country, but we're doing detailed studies of the East Coast. And it looks at each of the major metropolitan regions and looks at individual school districts, and it looks at in New York City at different types of schools in different boroughs of the city. The disappointing thing is, it's not just one place. It's not just New York, although New York has around 60% of all the students of color in the state. It's everywhere. And the efforts that have been made historically in places like Buffalo and a number of other upstate cities and some of the suburban communities have been largely abandoned or reversed by the federal courts since the Supreme Court became conservative back in the 1990s. Really, the courts have been pushing us backwards instead of forwards on these issues.
These figures, I understand that the figures you have been looking at and crunching span some 60 years, or is it 30?
Well, we looked in detail in the period from 1989 through 2010, but we have previously looked back into the 1960s. There really wasn't really good racial data in the country until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But since then, the pattern has been relatively clear. One of the things that people might want to do, since it's a long report, 160 pages, is take a look at it on our website, civilrightsproject.ucla.edu, or just search Civil Rights Project on Google, and you can read it yourself. And one of the important things about the report is that it shows that the segregation is not just by race. It's almost always double segregation by both race and poverty. So the typical white student or Asian student is in a middle-class school, and the typical African-American or Latino student is in a concentrated poverty school, which is related to all kinds of different different educational opportunities and probability of success.
So in other words, have we been seeing, based on the report, is there now a racial re-entrenchment occurring?
Well, New York really never desegregated. So it's not what's happening in the South right now is there is a re-entrenchment going on, although it's not nearly as bad as New York yet, because the South actually desegregated in the 60s. New York, except for some of these places that had court orders or desegregation plans, really didn't address this issue. No one ever had enough money to sue the New York City school system. And the New York state government, which started taking action against some of the smaller districts, especially in the 1970s, kind of backed off. It's an intensification in the sense that the poverty level in the segregated schools is getting higher. So the absolute separation from both white and Asian students and from middle-class students is getting deeper, and that's a chasm that people really have to cross, particularly when you get to college and into the labor market. And if you don't cross it until you're an adult, it becomes very, very difficult.
Now, the study has major impact in and of itself, but it is not the first time that the root causes of this inequities and inequalities, it is not the first time these things have been documented. Why is it that New York and many of the other Eastern Coast cities that you've looked at, why is it that there has been no movement on this very issue?
Well, in terms of the big national picture, the problem is that there has been no leadership. Last time Congress created a program to help students in schools that are diverse, help teachers and others do integration successfully was in 1972. The last major Supreme Court decision expanding desegregation rights came in 1973, to be followed the very next year by a radical limitation on those rights. We have no real effort. The only time that the country made a real effort to desegregate was between the middle 1960s and the early 1970s. Particularly during the Johnson administration. That was sufficient to transform the South, but the Supreme Court didn't even say northern districts had any responsibility to desegregate until 1973, and that ruling was never really seriously enforced, and it was limited. So we haven't had support or leadership from our courts, from our educational leaders, or from our politicians, and people just kind of have quietly assumed, like they did after Reconstruction, that this will be okay, that it doesn't matter. Maybe people like it that way, and we just will pretend we don't. It isn't there, and we'll just announce every few years a new program to raise standards and suppose that might produce equality. But it never has, and it probably never will, given the many dimensions of inequality that exist in these doubly segregated schools.
Well, we're looking also at, I'm trying to get my brain wrapped around the aggregate cost of this reality. Considering that this has gone on for several decades, how could it possibly be quantified, the impact and the loss of educational opportunity to children who, by accident of geography, essentially have had to forfeit a good education?
Now, these costs are staggering. I mean, if someone really started out to cost it out, the number would be incalculable. It would be vast, because basically if you are in a school like this, you're likely to be in a school that has less adequate programs, lower levels of competition, less connections with college, many other forms of inequality, the most inexperienced teachers, the most teachers teaching outside their subject, the least accelerated AP and other courses. And all of those things accumulate to a much lower chance of successfully attaining post-secondary education and getting a good income in your life. And even whether or not you get married, whether the family's stable, many, many, many things are affected by unequal education. And the failure to address it at all is a huge cost to the society. Now, there's other costs that aren't really economic costs, but that are social costs. We basically raise people in these extremely segregated societies with very little understanding of each other and each other's culture. So they miss that. It means our institutions that have to be interracial, from the military to our large corporations to many of our institutions, and even our political system, don't work as well as if we actually understood each other and knew how to work together effectively. So there's huge costs. These things are rooted in basic structures in New York, extreme housing segregation plus extreme fragmentation of the metropolitan areas where the vast majority of people live, into many, many school districts and many, many separate communities.
I keep going back to the you know, when we talk about racism and the apartheid system essentially under which we live, in especially in major cities like New York, people first of all would not want to acknowledge that that is in fact a reality, and secondly that the costs are generational. There are many generations of people who simply have not been able to take advantage of opportunities to improve their lives, because this is how it's done, and so it is basically fate. You know, you can't do anything about it. And then we have this notion that it couldn't possibly be the case, because after all, these are so-called liberal cities, and you have liberal mayors and liberal legislators and liberal president with a liberal secretary of education. How could these things be happening?
Well, you know, many people in New York, when you talk about race with them, will say we're such a diverse area, and that's true. And all of the growth of New York State is non-white, especially Latino and Asian right now. But it's four major races. And people think because they see each other on the street or the subway or at the ball game or wherever that everything's all right. But they don't think about the fact that the default experience is fundamentally different if you're white or Asian or if you're black or you're Latino, and that there's so much segregation that people literally have no idea of how the other groups live or what kind of opportunities they exist. People like to believe that the public schools offer fair opportunities for everybody, and if they don't, the charter schools will step in. Turns out the charter schools are even more segregated. People don't want to think about this, especially people who are privileged. They want to think it's okay. They want to believe that it's diverse. They want to think nothing needs to be done. And they just don't want to hear much about it.
But it's also on the flip side. The people who are the victims of it also feel so overwhelmed. They feel that they can't do anything about it. So I ask you, as an attorney, is there a legal remedy here for this awful predicament?
Well, I'm not an attorney, although I do teach in law school and do work in civil rights cases. But, what's the law? The law is what's interpreted by our high courts, and it's what is enacted by our legislators. Of course there could be legal remedies, at least for some of this. I mean, it's so vast. Talking about solving it all, it would be very difficult to imagine. But there is no question that if we wanted, for example, to take our schools of choice and all the charter schools that are created, 97% of which in Manhattan are intensely segregated, and apply some civil rights policies to them to assure that the choices are fair, that people have transportation to get to their schools of choice, that the schools can't choose the students can choose the schools, that there's not test barriers and so forth. we would give a lot of kids an opportunity for an integrated education. Right now, most of the growth of segregation in New York and our other big states is in the suburbs. Couldn't we take some action to end some of the really vicious housing and mortgage lending discrimination and open up more areas? Couldn't we help diverse areas to develop plans for successful, lasting integration rather than just another, still another process of resegregation and running further away? Of course we could do some of those things. We're really not trying. We're not even talking about it. But there are things that could be done, and we have page after page of suggestions of things that New York could think about.
Since the publication of this report, what reaction have you gotten?
Well, we heard from lots of folks in New York, and it's been in scores of newspapers around the state. It's been seriously covered by the media. We haven't heard any politicians. I've heard from any politicians who want some proposals. We'd be happy to talk to any of them. But we haven't really heard from significant civil rights organizations as yet, although we have been in communication with some of them in New York.
Well, finally, Dr. Orfield, is there a bright spot anywhere that you see in this report?
Well, I think there are. There are some places that are lastingly diverse in metropolitan New York. There are places that had good records in the past, like the very good magnet school program historically in Buffalo. Senator Moynihan was a big supporter of that magnet school legislation. Right next door in Connecticut, there are regional magnets that draw students from cities and suburbs together in integrated settings. And they've been very successful. They're voluntary, and people want to go to them, and there are waiting lists in many of them. It seems to me that people in New York ought to be able to drive up across the border, take a look at some of those schools, and think, you know, this really isn't that hard. One of the things that's optimistic about this process of studying this issue is this really isn't very hard in operation, and students of all racial groups gain from it. If it's done well, they gain understanding of each other, they enrich their background, they learn how to live and work more successfully in a diverse society. You know, there's not going to be any majority group in the future of New York. Everybody's going to be a minority. It's very, very valuable to everybody to understand each other and to know how to work with each other and to understand each other's background. And it's exciting to people when they do it successfully. So, you know, once you get across the line and you do something, this is a very positive experience for most people.
Well, thank you, Professor Orfield, for being with us today and giving us a quick tour through this very alarming study. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Well, I go back to this question when we talk about, well, you know, education is a big deal for me, and I've been talking about this. We've seen what's been going on, and here, time and again, the figures and statistics point to the same problem, except this particular report is just so damning. It is just so alarming that you just don't know how many more years will people have to tolerate this for it to become clear in their minds that this is a serious emergency and that a political system that does not pay attention to these issues, despite the fact that they know it. They have the information, they have the statistics, their studies, their surveys, all kinds of evidence to say it's time to reorganize our policies because our policies not only are failing, worse, they're not even thinking of implementing new policies to meet these challenges. So, this is real. This is how life is lived in major cities, and we think that segregation, you think it's associated with the South. It is not. it is practically universal now in the United States. Apartheid is real. Well, let's take this couple of minutes of seconds, I should say, of music, and we come back to the next segment in our program today. Story of the U.S. Postal Service, and we've been covering the intention by a so-called bipartisan effort in Congress to overhaul, which means privatize and just whittle away at the Postal Service, and we've been discussing different aspects of it. Today, I want to talk about a division within the U.S. Postal Service that is being targeted. And it is being targeted because there's a strong suspicion that it will be privatized, that that is the intention. Joining me now is, let's see, Greg Stinson. Greg, are you on the air?
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Greg, for being with us. Greg, you are affiliated. This is with the truck drivers and the machinists, right?
The truck drivers.
Tell us about why the truck drivers have a reason to be fearful.
Well, over my 30 years of being a tractor trailer operator for the Postal Service, we've seen more and more postal vehicle service truck driving jobs being eliminated and that service given to outside trucking companies. And even though at some points the amount of money they're is costing them is more than what it would cost to have postal employees do the work.
Could you tell us what the truck division does within the U.S. Postal Service? What do the trucks do? Why are they necessary?
The trucking industry within the Postal Service is, whether it be postal employees or highway contractors, is the only way that the mail, when the mail gets processed at a processing facility, the trucks take the mail to the various post offices at very early morning hours so that the carriers will have the mail to deliver. And then in the afternoons, the mail that the carriers collect and bring back to their stations, that is all collected and transported by trucks back to the processing facility so they can process it for the next morning. And it's such that we're an essential part of getting the mail from the processing facility to the letter carriers and getting the letter carriers' mail that they've collected back to the processing facilities.
Now, what is the intent by this congressional committee to overhaul the Postal Service? How would that affect the trucking division?
It would, by them privatizing the post office and doing what Congress is wanting to do, is basically trying to turn all postal employee jobs over to the private sector.
Okay. And how, if they do that, what will the impact be?
Well, and what I've seen over the last, in the last year with some of the work that's just recently been contracted out, we provide a service. It's not just truck driving jobs. We provide a service. We take an oath of office to protect the sanctity of the mail. And we're dedicated employees. We're dedicated to providing a service to our customers, the public. Mm-hmm. And I've seen myself that these people in the private sector that are doing our work, to them it's just a job. All they're doing is driving a truck. And their dedication to making sure the mail gets delivered on time doesn't exist.
Could you give us an idea? You're in Oregon. Could you tell us in your particular station, theoretically, how many trucks are basically active in your particular division, and how many jobs would essentially be lost if privatization occurs?
Well, several years ago, we had up probably 2006, we had as many as 86 drivers, and now we have 48. And now managements want to reduce that even more to 44. And it's the cost factor. In April of last, 13th of last year, they eliminated 7 more of our full-time jobs and contracted that work out. And I went and did the math and realized that just in Portland, Oregon, and our motor vehicle service, which is a very small sliver within the United States Postal Service, but just in our small segment, they're giving the work to a company that didn't have enough semi-trailers. The Postal Service says, no problem, we'll lease the trailers and let you use our trailers. They didn't have enough tractors. So the Postal Service, decided, no problem, we will spend $30,000 a month to lease tractors for you to use. And we're also, I found out through my investigation, paying for the fuel, paying for the oil, and paying basically $59 an hour for these employees to do our work, where our pay with our benefits is only $46 an hour. And so doing all the math, it came out to the post office is wasting $2,383,000 a year.
That's just from your unit?
Yes. And this is giving work and money to a company that in April of 2012 filed their fourth bankruptcy.
Well, we're joined by Kevin Cole. Kevin is in California. Hello, Kevin.
Hi.
Good to be with you today.
Thank you.
Well, you've heard a bit of what Greg Stinson was saying. What does it look like? What does the picture look like where you are? Tell us where you are in California.
We're in Anaheim, California. In our area, Southern California, our Santa Ana district has a number of large plants that has PVS, that has postal vehicle service, and
how many trucks are operating where you are?
Well, I mean, in California, there's 400 vehicles that were at risk when privatization was considered. There's 400 vehicles required retrofitting at a cost of about $11,000 or $12,000 each.
How is it that the post office, I mean, Greg is talking about some privatization already occurring and the post office spending in excess of what they ought to, and in excess of what they actually are paying. How is this allowed under union contract rules?
Well, you know, actually what was it attempted, a little over a year ago, that it actually wasn't contractually permitted, and that's why we prevailed, you know, in arbitration. So we, you know, went to arbitration. We challenged that there's two portions to one of our contract articles that One that clearly says that that we have input and an opportunity to make a cost comparison, and another portion of the contract that mentions that management has to notify the union. Management was citing the second portion, saying that they that all they had to do was notify the union, and they you know went on unilaterally and attempted to contract out the PVS in California. Ended up we went to arbitration and prevailed, and they do have to allow cost comparisons, and if it's determined that we can do it more affordably, then they have to use the postal vehicle service.
Now, how much really is going to be saved if the jobs are cut? I mean, is this a remedy for so supposedly reforming the U.S. Postal Service?
No, there's not. There isn't. There isn't a real. Okay. There isn't a savings in the long run. It's not more efficient, and it's not cost effective. The one thing that the Postal Service pointed out, their contention is that in making cost comparisons, we can't cite owning anything, and so the Postal Service actually attempted to make an argument that the union doesn't own anything, and that in cost comparisons that we couldn't cite the fact that we already possess the vehicles to do the work and the workforce to do the work.
Well, May Day is coming up, and May Day is a classic day for union activity. What is planned with respect to the U.S. Postal Service and the effort to resist this move by Congress to overhaul, quote-unquote, the Postal Service?
Well, I mean, actually, there we have a day of action. May Day is coming up. We have a day of action planned on Thursday, the 24th of April, that will, to go to Staples stores throughout the nation and to challenge Postal Service attempts to privatize the window sections.
We covered some of that. That is part of the plan now to open up these boutique centers within Staples. But considering that many Staples stores themselves are being closed because they're not doing such good business, is Staples a good idea? Would it not cave in on itself?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that it isn't a good idea. And I guess in the 80s, there was an attempt to privatize the window using Sears, and we know the status of Sears at this point. So it's been attempted. The retail operations, they've attempted to push it out to private industry, and it hasn't panned out in the past, and it won't pan out this time.
Greg, in Portland, what's happening come May Day? How are you guys protesting? What is happening?
I'm not sure what the union has planned. I know there's an organization and there's a section of it in Portland called the Communities and Postal Workers United. It's a nationwide group, but a gentleman by the name of Jamie Partridge kind of heads that, and I'm sure they'll be scheduling some rallies for that day, and they've been doing a lot of protesting at various processing facilities within Portland, and been striving to try and get meetings with our local upper management, even to the point that they have two dates, one in May and one in June, where they have to, a small group of them were arrested and have to appear in local and federal court on charges that they've been disrupting the flow of mail.
Is there a big date that is looming over this particular division? Has there been some indication that by this date we will be phasing out the trucking divisions and replacing them? Has that language yet appeared?
No, we haven't seen anything. And the frustrating part for our local union is that for 32 years prior to our current contract, the language that management used to subcontract workout was that they just had five factors they had to consider, like employee availability, equipment availability, public interest and stuff. And under our current contract, as Brother Cole mentioned, under a new contract, it says that if we can do the work at the same cost or less, then the contract requires them to give the work to postal employees. And as I was talking about earlier, the work that they're giving, that they've given away just in the last year, is costing them far more. And so it's, whether it be the trucking industry or the clerk craft jobs being given to Staples, has been my philosophy over the years that they don't care whether it costs more or not. This is simply a way to slowly privatize the post office and turn the whole thing over to the private sector.
Kevin, is there in your area a kind of drop dead date by which things will be done, or is it the same thing? It's just creeping up, and basically they will do it as long as they're not confronted.
Yeah, there isn't a drop dead date. There, it does appear that it's just going to, be some, kind of as a matter of course. They're going to, to attempt to, challenge the service and attempt to privatize. But it doesn't appear to be a drop, a set date. That we need to be concerned about. It's more just a general, push toward privatization.
Well, I want to thank you, Kevin Cole and Greg Stinson, for bringing us up to date to this particular aspect of what is likely to happen, what the challenge is for the U.S. postal workers. And, of course, I support the U.S. postal workers. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Yutri.
Thank you. We come back to our final segment right after this little musical blurb. Well, remember that not too long ago, it was just about a week and a little bit more than that, that President Obama appeared at the National Action Network's 16th annual convention, and of course he didn't come bearing good news about all the things that he has done for this particular constituency. Instead, he brought the customary speech about the importance of voting and how it is important to vote to get a lot of changes made so that people can, in fact, have a better life. And, of course, when he was talking to the National Action Network crowd, largely African American, he basically said, "We need you to get out there and go and do the work. We need you to get involved in the community and go out there and get us, squeeze every vote down that you could possibly find, because they're after you." It's a little kind of implicit threat, that you should be concerned because somebody intends to do you great harm. We've been hearing that for a long time, too. Well, right on the heels of that comes a news release yesterday that the Reverend Al Sharpton and his National Action Network will be gearing up to launch Freedom Summer. It's a take on the old Freedom Summers of years gone by in the 60s, when people actually were in the field, pardon the pun, to do field work at building a political constituency by voter registration. And the plan, as announced, is to focus on 8 states: Arkansas, Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, North Carolina, Ohio, Texas, and Virginia. And they're looking for volunteers to go out there and drum up the vote. Well, we saw that coming, because that's the only message, essentially, that President Obama has for African Americans. Just tote that barge and lift that bale, because the Democratic Party needs you. Not that I'm here to report to you on what I so far have delivered in my 5th year of my 8 years in office. I'm here to share with you the good news of all the great things that I have accomplished in your behalf. So I decided that we ought to mount a counteroffensive. And it is offensive, actually, to tell black people, especially African Americans, to go tell these folks, based on complete non-performance on the major issues, we just covered one, education, and that New York, the same city that the president came to talk to the folks in, is the most segregated public school system in the nation, right? He has a secretary of education, as I've talked about many, many times. This theme should offend people. We ought to be offended by this. Let's go and get out the vote because they're trying to prevent us from voting and all this kind of stuff. First of all, it's not new. Secondly, what is the Democratic Party doing about it? Last that I know, in Florida itself, the Democratic Party refused to protect the integrity of the black vote when George Bush stole the election. Al Gore refused to protest. Refuse to honor the integrity of the black vote. So you can't play games with the black vote and now tell people, we need you to come out and do this field work, help us go out and find these folks who are not yet registered and get them registered. No. First of all, that's a job. That is not for volunteers. And considering that this president has not delivered jobs to African Americans, the very least that they can do is use this as an employment opportunity. Don't do anything unless you get paid. Period. Why should black people be volunteering to go build your Democratic Party for free? Why should they volunteer at all for a party that hasn't delivered very much for them? The other piece of it is, and I've referred to this before, all that work, that all that sincere work, that honest work, that hard work that went into building momentum and building the voting bloc, a solid voting bloc for Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. They went door to door, street by street, house by house, town by town, and they got all these figures, they got all this information, and they brought it back. And it became an industry. It became a consulting firm. All the stuff that they gathered for free, that they brought back, all this information was synthesized by Obama's campaign handlers, you know, the smart people. They have the blacks do the field work and bring them what essentially would become a multi-million dollar business for them. And they're now operating, of course, as Organizing for Action and other forms of consulting firms that they now have that are being hired by political wannabes or people looking for re-election. They want to retain the services. So these people who did that for free have brought in the knowledge and the information that has helped a choice few launch several political consulting agencies that are charging tons of money using that information. And I am going to bet you that you will not see too much diversity in those companies. And this is so offensive to ask black folks who can't get a job, who have an unemployment rate more than twice as high as the national rate, who have longer terms of unemployment than any other ethnic group, who have no jobs for their young people of working age, to issue this call. We want you to volunteer. Somebody should say, hey, wait a minute. I know you're not talking to me. I know you're not suggesting that I without a job, and I'm supposed to go out there in the sun and do, you know, like the good old days, I'm going to do the field work for you, and I'm going to bring back all the goodies, and you will take what I generate for you for free, and it will now be part of your consulting practice, and I have not seen a penny. I say, folks, be wise. Don't go out there volunteering, not for this party. It hasn't done you very much good, and it will not do you very much good. And they proved it again. To have the temerity, given the abysmal record of performance, and they use the word performance very loosely here, this president hasn't performed much at all for African Americans. And to assume it is the height of egotism to believe that he's entitled to ask anybody to do anything. But in as much as they're asking us to do the kind of work for which we have been well suited and accustomed. Get out there in the field. You go out there in the hot sun. And you bring us back what we need, and we'll take it from there. Thank you so much. It's so kind of you to volunteer. Absolutely not. Let them show a nice bit of creativity. Let them translate these volunteer positions into paid positions. Since the president has not been able to generate jobs, and since Al Sharpton hasn't been able to generate jobs in support of the president, let them now use all of that fundraising that they've been doing to support candidates wanting to run and to make sure Nancy Pelosi regains her divinely ordained seat as the majority leader of the House, and to situate Hillary Clinton for a safe run in 2016. Since they can do all of that, they can raise the money to do all of that, let them raise the money to pay you to do whatever it is they need to have done for this dreadful party called the Democratic Party that continues to insult black people, continues to ignore their interests, continues to turn the other way when they know they have a mandate to fulfill. This president does not deserve one bit of your volunteer activity, nor does the party. Amen and amen and amen. All right, now, I have spoken. This brings us to the end of the program today, and I hope it gives you pause to think about things. It is really important that we begin to understand that the dots should be connected. When we started the program today about the awful state of racial, basically apartheid. Apartheid is the reality in New York. Your children are going to apartheid schools. And that is their lot. People are saying, well, you know, it's so hard to change and so forth, because these children are not seen as worthy of an effort to do the right thing. They're not seen as people important enough to lobby for and to protect and to advocate for. You leave them, generations have already basically been denied a reasonable shot at life because they're in horrible schools by design, by purpose, by intent. And then we have these leaders who have no answers, but they could tell you what you can do for them for free. Get the heck out of here. Absolutely not. Do absolutely nothing for this party unless you get paid, because what you do for free, they will translate into a huge multi-million dollar consulting agency that even you can't afford to hire. Thanks so much for being with me today. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. You can drop me a line at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lee. Take care.